This is Radio International. I'm Harry Manis with Jan Tennant. And this week, another in our series of productions awarded the Italia Prize for Radio. It's the 1974 drama winner, The Mystery, a comedy by Bill Naughton. Here's a short preview.
Grock, you're an idiot. Sitting there, strapped down in your armchair, pale-faced and sweating with your lips shut. Silence! You should realize above all that silence is the best radio. Actors fear it, directors don't understand it, writers ignore it, but listeners stretch their eardrums.
So do you, swine.
Just missed, old chap. I say, Grock, to be serious for a moment, don't you realize who we are? We are the mediocrities. The mediocrities. You can't beat us. We don't allow your sort to get the upper hand. We nip you in the bud. We are in charge of the whole world over. We recognize each other, understand each other, help each other. It is the conspiracy of all time. The conspiracy of mediocrity. We simply use your sort.
I'll kick your butt.
Missed again. Rotten shot.
Being naughty is here. We'll soon put a stop to that.
We'll hear The Mystery, the prize-winning BBC play, complete and in stereo, in about a half hour from now. And following it, a bonus from another BBC unit, the music department. It's an excerpt from one of their enormously popular Henry Wood prom concerts, the final one of the 1969 season, where by tradition the audience brought along noisemakers and cheered the musicians as if they were a football team.
And to begin this week, back to the drama department and a broadcasting milestone. BBC Radio's very first play written for the medium. We'll hear a newly produced stereo version of it. Its title is Danger, and it runs just over 15 minutes. To introduce it, here's its producer, Raymond Rakes, with its writer.
It was Richard Hughes who was asked by the British Broadcasting Company, as it then was, in January 1924, to write a play for effect by sound only in the same way that film plays at that time were written for effect by sight only. This play, Danger, thus became the first listening play, an experiment in a new medium which has since been considerably developed. Indeed, now, quite 50 years later, you may be hearing this play in stereo. Danger was first produced by Sir Nigel Playfair, whose productions at the Lyric Theatre Hammersmith in London, notably The Beggar's Opera, had brought him much fame. And it was first broadcast from the London station of the British Broadcasting Company on January the 15th, 1924. Mr. Hughes, tell us what you remember about the first production.
Well, it all came about like this. I was bringing a small company of Welsh actors to London to perform at Playfair's Lyric Theatre, Hammersmith. And I was dining with Playfair to talk about it. One night, he told me that he'd got to fill 2 hours of broadcasting time the following Tuesday, and that he was going to have some dialogue from Jane Austen read by actors, that he'd got a dialogue that A.P. Herbert had published in Punch, similarly was going to be read by actors. And he then said, well, of course, really, this is an entirely new medium and really needs something written specially for it. I said, I couldn't agree more. He said, well, awful pity there isn't time to ask you to do something for it. I said, what do you mean there isn't time? He said, I've got to take my program into the BBC at Savoy Hill lunchtime tomorrow. And so I said, well, let me have a try. I sat up all night, wrote the play, and took it to him at breakfast. And I argued to myself like this. There'd never been before anything which people had had to take in by their ears only. Anything dramatic, I mean. So it occurred to me that obviously the best thing was to choose a theme which would happen entirely in the dark. And an accident in a coal mine suggested itself. And that's how it came that I wrote this play, beginning with the lines, "The lights have gone out," hoping that everybody would listen in the dark and get the feeling of the darkness that way.
Am I right in believing that on the very first broadcast, the announcer who presented the play asked the listeners, to turn out their lights when they were listening?
Yes, he did. I think that most of them probably did. We got something over 1,000 letters and postcards the next 2 or 3 days arrived at the BBC about it.
I've got some press cuttings here that you received from the broadcast, and I think the most exciting thing tells of a letter from Ellen Terry, the great tragedian, saying, "No greater performance have I ever heard which has produced such a thrill on an unseen audience. Another step forward has been taken by the BBC." Another press cutting here. I see that before the broadcasting of the radio drama A Comedy of Danger, listeners in who suffered from neurasthenia were advised to switch off for 25 minutes, as a play was about to be performed of a Grand Guignol character. Those who wished to listen were advised to switch off the lights in order to get the right atmosphere.
Yes, well, I think it did make a certain amount of stir, certainly. And, of course, the press were very much interested, and a whole lot of them, journalists, turned up at Savoy Hill to hear it on the spot.
So the journalists had a sort of private playback of the play as it was actually being performed?
As it was being performed, because, of course, there was no recording in those days. Everything was live.
You were telling me the story about the explosion in the play.
Yes, well, of course, we knew nothing when we started in this production as to what noises were possible. We had only one microphone, and there was no control panel. And we, amongst the things we found, of course, was an explosion. Any louder than the popping of a sweet bag would blow all the fuses. And that didn't worry Playfair. He put the journalists in a room with their own loudspeaker to listen to the play, and he gave them a private explosion of their own in the next room, which they got through the wall.
Well, I hope that now we are able to give the explosion a certain degree of realism that 50 years ago, perhaps, was not quite possible.
50 years ago, we had to rely on the effects man from the Tivoli Cinema, who came round with his wind machine and his other apparatus.
I see. And he did the effects. So they were theatrical effects, stage effects brought into the broadcasting studio.
Yes.
Of course, there are Welsh miners who have to sing. What did you do about them?
Well, in those days, I'm afraid, there were plenty of unemployed Welsh miners singing on the curb for coppers. And we simply walked out into the Strand, collected the nearest Welsh choir, and brought them in. Because having only one microphone, the difficulty was that they'd no conception of when to start and when to stop. In other words, once they'd started singing, nothing would make them stop. So Playfair put them outside in the corridor, where they sang continuously. And he opened the soundproof door when he wanted the sound of their singing to come over. Closed it when he didn't want them anymore. They'd no idea. They just went on happily singing until they were turned out. Incidentally, I was going over to New York shortly after this production. I tried to sell the idea of radio drama to American broadcasting. And they said this might be all very well for an English audience, but that they couldn't see an American audience ever taking to it.
How wrong they were.
Indeed.
And now a new production, just over 50 years since it all began, the birth of radio drama. Here is Danger by Richard Hughes. And in the cast, you're going to hear Christopher Good playing the part of Jack, Carol Marsh as Mary, and Carlton Hobbs as Mr. Bax. Carlton Hobbs, who is also celebrating his 50 years in radio. And Richard Hughes, what was that advice that the announcer gave to the listeners on the first broadcast?
He asked them to turn their lights out and to listen in complete darkness. And so I'd like to suggest now that you do the same, that you turn your lights out and sit in the dark and listen to this play, which all happens in the dark.
Blood, 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 blood. lights have gone out.
Where are you?
Here.
Where? I can't find you.
Here. I'm holding my hand out.
I can't find it.
Why here?
What's that?
Oh, it's all right, enemy.
Oh, you did frighten me, touching me suddenly like that in the dark. No idea you were so close.
Catch hold of my hand. Whatever happens, we mustn't lose each other.
That's better. But the lights, why have they gone out?
I don't know. I suppose something's gone wrong with the dynamo. They'll turn them up again in a minute.
Jack, I hate the dark.
Cheer up, darling. It'll be all right in a minute or two.
It's so frightfully dark down here.
No wonder. There must be nearly 1,000 feet between us and the daylight. It's not surprising it's a bit dusky.
I didn't know there could be such utter blackness as this ever. It's so dark. It's as if there never was such a thing as light anywhere. Jack, it's like being blind.
They'll turn the lights up again soon.
I wish we'd never come down this beastly coal mine. I knew something would go wrong.
It'll be all right, dear. It's only the lights.
Where are the others?
They're just on ahead. Not far.
Suppose we get lost.
We can't get lost, Mary, darling.
Wish you hadn't wanted to drop behind the others. Jack, I'm afraid of the dark.
My mistake. Buck up, Mary, old girl. It'll soon be over.
I wish we hadn't left those miner's lamp things they gave us behind. Listen. There's someone coming.
Oh, the incompetent beings. Turning the lights off just when visitors like ourselves are seeing the place. I call this a coal mine.
It's Mr. Bax.
Damn dark rabbit hole, I call it. A rotten rat hole. A dratty, wet, smelly drain pipe. That's a dithering thing.
Hello?
Hello? Who's there? Of all the stupid, meddlesome idiots.
Mr. Bax, what's happened? Is it all right?
Is it all right indeed? Leaving us suddenly in the dark like this.
But has there been an accident?
Oh, goodness knows. I'd expect anything of a country like Wales. They've got a climate like the flood and a language like the Tower of Babel. And then they go and lure us into the bowels of the earth and turn the lights off. Dark. Wretched, incompetent, and their houses are full of cockroaches.
Well, I suppose the only thing to do is to sit and wait for the lights to go up again.
There's no danger, is there?
No, young lady, there's no danger. But it's damned unpleasant.
Oh, I don't know. I'm beginning to think it's rather fun.
Well, if you can find any fun in breaking your shins in the dark.
Why don't you call it fun, being in a pit disaster?
But this isn't a disaster, it's only the light.
Of course, silly. You don't think it would be fun if it was a real disaster, do you? But the lights going out might have meant a disaster. And think how thrilling it's going to be to talk about it afterwards. I say, Jack.
Yes?
Let's pretend it's serious.
What do you mean?
Well, let's pretend it's a real disaster and we're cooped up here forever and we'll never be able to get out again.
Don't joke about it.
Why not? There's no real danger, is there? Let's get all the thrills we can.
Well, of all the morbid young people nowadays.
I love thrills. Let's pretend the roof has fallen in. They can't get at us.
Very well. What a baby you are. Here we are, my dear. Buried alive.
Oh, Jack!
Alas, they will never find us.
Oh, Jack!
Well?
I'm so frightened.
What's that?
About the roof having fallen in.
But it hasn't. It's only pretense.
Yes, but when I pretend, it seems so real.
Oh, don't pretend.
But I want to pretend. I want to be frightened. Only hold my hand tight, won't you? Now, go on.
We shall suffocate or starve, or both, my dear, in each other's arms.
Oh, Jack. And
even death shall not part us.
Oh, Jack, don't. It's too awful.
There'll be articles in all the newspapers.
Oh, I wish I could read them.
You can't have your funeral and watch it, young lady.
Oh, this is fun. I wouldn't have missed it for anything. Won't I make Daddy's flesh creep? Oh.
Good God, Mary.
Jack.
Quiet, you little fool. Let go. You're frightening me. Let go of me. You, how do you expect to be able to breathe if you're screaming all the breath out of your body? Quiet! Pull yourself together. We're all right. We're not hurt.
No, sir, we're not hurt. But listen. Water.
Idiot.
What's that roaring?
It Send me the echo. Oh,
Mr. Bax, can't we find the others?
I don't think we could, young lady. It wouldn't be much use to us if we did.
Oh, God.
They're no better off than we are.
Well, listen, that must be them. That must be the others. They can't be very far off. Let's call to them.
Sound carries a long way in the tunnel. But listen. Those chaps.
You're finding some good in the Welsh, then, after all.
The echo's getting louder. Jack, it isn't an echo. It's water. Mine's flooding. We'll be drowned.
I wish I had the faith of those chaps, sir. It would make dying easier.
Oh, Jack, I don't want to die yet. I won't.
It's got to come sometime, young lady. Isn't it better for it to happen now in your lover's arms? Death might have parted you two, instead of which he's simply joining you closer together.
I want to live.
Shut up, you old fool. Okay. It's all very well to be stoical about death at your age, but we're young. We've got all life before us.
Can't you keep quiet about it then, you young jackanapes? You think I want to die either? But it ain't good manners to talk about it. Where'd we be if we all started screaming about it, eh? Now, you behave yourself, sir. Those chaps over there, they don't want to die either, but they don't make a fuss about it. They sing hymns. If you and I don't feel like singing hymns, we can at least behave like gentlemen.
Behave like gentlemen, indeed. I tell you, it's all very well for an old chap like you. We'd die anyway in a year or two, but it's different for us. We're young.
Well, if you want to make a scene, you shall have one, sir. Do you think it's any easier for the old to die than the young? I tell you, it's harder, sir, harder. Life's like a trusted friend. He grows more precious as the years go by. What's your life to mine? A shadow, sir. Yours, 20-odd years of imbecile childhood, lunatic youth. The rest a mere rosy presumption of the future. Mine, 60 solid years of solid real living. No mere rosy dream. Do you think it's as easy for me to leave my solid substance as you to leave your... trumpery shadow.
What's your life worth to the world? Who's dependent on you? What good are you to anyone?
And what good are you, young man?
One person's dependent on me, anyhow.
You mean that you're loved by this young lady? If you both die, what loss is that to the world? Two opposite quantities cancelling out.
You beast. You cruel beast.
I must speak, madam, in common justice to my age, since that young cub started such it. The old are always being twitted with their unwillingness to die. It is the most natural thing in the world that it should be the young, who haven't a notion what life really is, who should be ready to chuck it away for any bootling reason that comes along.
Look here, instead of talking like this, let's do something. Let's make some sort of attempt at escape.
What do you propose to do, young man?
Why, look for some way out. We can't stay here and drown like rats in a cage.
If you start to walk, my boy, you'll start to run. And if you start to run, you'll get into a panic and go mad in the dark. I'd rather die with my wits about me.
I'd rather not die at all.
Keeping still is the only thing for us if we don't want to lose our heads. Now remember, we're goodness knows how far into the side of the hill. What earthly hope do you think there is of finding our way out?
Dark. I do hate the dark. I think I could go more easily if I could see light just once before it happened.
Here it comes. Listen.
Yes, it'll be on us in another 5 minutes.
Pray heaven it finishes us off quickly.
Think of dying somewhere out in the open, in the sunlight. Me able to see you and you able to see me. Oh, what bliss it would be.
It's strange how little chaps wonder about what will happen to them after death. He hardly thinks about it. But I don't know. How thrilled we should be if we met a chap who really knew. In 5 minutes, we're going to know ourselves, all three of us. I've always wanted to travel. Now I'm going to.
Oh, Jack, my poor dear.
Mary, do you know, I'm beginning to feel as excited about it as a child going to the seaside for the first time. Aren't you?
Jack, how queer you are. I never looked at it like that.
Well, I wasn't in any hurry to die. But now it's coming, I feel sort of proud of myself. As if it was a very wonderful thing to manage to pull off.
Oh, Jack, darling.
There's only one thing I'm sorry about.
What is it?
I've forgotten the luggage.
Jack.
Pull yourself together, sir. Keep control.
It's all right, Bax. I'm not getting off my nut. I mean what I say. What do you think I've got to live for, besides myself and Mary? Why, my work. If it wasn't for that, Bax, I'd go to death without caring a tuppenny damn. I'd die just for the fun of the thing, to see what it felt like.
I shouldn't worry about death if I was you. The world will get on all right without you. Never you fear.
Jack, the water's coming. It's over my feet.
Courage, darling.
Oh, Jack, I don't want to die. I hate it. I loathe it. I want to live.
Don't make it harder, dear. You don't think it's fun for me, you having to die?
Jack, it's awful. Only for an hour more. Oh, I do want to live another hour. Jack, there was something I wanted to say to you. I can't remember it. But I must remember. It'll be too late soon. Oh, Jack.
Oh, God. Can't I be allowed to finish my work?
Damn your work, sir. You think you're the only one dying before his time? I tell you, every man dies before his time, even if he lives till he's as old as Methuselah.
Oh, it's up to my knees.
Don't clutch at me like that, Mary. It won't do any good.
But the water, the current's washing me away.
I've got you. And I've got my other arm round the wooden thing.
Hold tight, then.
I've got you tight.
Oh, only I could see you.
Just think of all the things I'd meant to do.
Shut up about the things you meant to do, you young cub. Will you realize we're all in the same boat, and it's as hard on me to die as you, or worse, by God, 1,000 times worse.
You hoary old sinner, can't you prepare to get out of the world instead of cursing at me?
Oh, Jack, let's pray.
Pray if you like, Mary, I can't.
Jack, don't.
Help! Help! I can't die, I won't die, I'm an old man, I won't. I won't!
Hold yourself in, you old coward.
Poor Mr. Bax. I'm quite calm now. I don't mind dying a bit.
Nor do I. Now it's so close.
Help me! Help! Help! Help!
No good, Mr. Bax. No one can possibly hear us. The only thing is to keep calm. It won't be long
now. Oh, help! Help! Help!
What's that? Listen.
Help! Help me! It's up to my waist!
Shut up, Bax. We want to listen. My God. Someone tapping.
We're here.
Father Lamont!
Listen. They'll find our bodies. That's all.
They'll find us if they're quick enough.
Father Lamont, still! That's right.
They can't possibly be quick enough. Besides, I don't want them to find me.
It's a strange thing, Mary. Before, I looked on death as a terrible thing. And now, I'm so nearly dead, I wouldn't come back to life for anything. There's such a lot to find out. The other side.
Help! Be quicker, you fools! Quicker! We're drowning!
Stop it, Bax. They won't be in time. Why can't you behave sensibly?
Jack, darling, I'll never leave you.
How do you know they'll let you stay with him, you little fool? What do you know of death? I tell you, death isn't heaven and it isn't hell. Death's dying, you young dolts. Death's been nothing. Not even a dratted ghost clanking its chains on the staircase.
My soul's immortal, Mr. Bax. I know that.
Well, if your soul's immortal, is your mind immortal? Or is your soul going to wander about without one like an imbecile, eh? You young fools, you never thought. I have. Oh, my God, I have. These last 10 years.
Oh, Jack. Jack, it's up to my chin. Oh, help me.
Let me lift you in my arms, darling. Then, when it gets up to my chin, we'll die together.
Oh, it isn't true. What has been seen?
No, darling. Of course it isn't true.
Hurry up, you dolts! You blockhead! Smash your way in! We're drowning, I tell you! Drowning! Quick! Quick!
Goodbye, Jack, dear.
My God! It must be nearly through. God, this suspense. How much longer before we know whether we're going to live or die? I don't care which, but I do want to know.
Look, there's a light. A hole in the roof. Quick, quick.
That's true.
An old man.
There's a girl here.
Put the rope on her. Right.
Yes. Come along, young lady. Come along. I've got the rope. Put it round you.
She's fainted.
Never mind. Pass her up. She'll be all right.
Have the bite of the rope round her shoulder.
Yes. Like this.
Well, she had the thrill she wanted, all right.
Paul?
Oh. All right above there. Have you got her?
Right. Now the neck.
Up you go, quick, Mr. Bax. The water's still rising.
No, my boy, after you. You're more value in the world than I am.
Nonsense, sir, after you. You're an older man than I am. Quick, sir, or there won't be any time.
You've got Mary to think of. Now, Jack, haul away above there.
Oh. Oh. Oh.
No, lower me. It's me you're calling up, and it ought to be back.
We'll have you up, sir.
There's no time to waste.
You all right?
I'm all right. Lower away.
Below there. Crack hold.
Quickly, catch on the rope, quick. Bax, have you got it? Aye. Bax? Good God, he's gone.
A recreation of Danger. The very first play written for radio, broadcast on the BBC on January 15, 1924. In this recent production, Carlton Hobbs played Mr. Bax, Carol Marsh, Mary, and Christopher Good, Jack. It was produced by Raymond Rakes.
There's quite a contrast in the style and approach of our major work this week on Radio International, The Mystery, a comedy drama that won the BBC the 1974 Italia Prize. And we'll be hearing it in a few minutes from now. But before we do, it might be interesting to stay in radio's past for a moment or two and hear how that very first radio drama writer, Richard Hughes, felt about his play Danger when it was broadcast back in 1924. He reads his own article in the London Evening Standard, which appeared the next day.
When listeners in last night fitted on their headphones and turned out their lights, they had little idea of the scene going on in the BBC studio. I hadn't until I saw my play being rehearsed. Imagine a long, empty room, rather like a stage temple, with thick carpets and hangings on the walls and ceiling to deaden any possible echo. No furniture, only a thing in the middle like a heathen altar, the microphone, and brilliant electric light. And yet, in front of this strange altar stand three devotees, typescript in hand. You listen to what they're saying. They're complaining of the darkness. Suddenly one of them, a girl, rushes to the end of the room, flings open the door, and screams out onto the landing, then rushes back to her place. If she screamed too close to the microphone, the fuses would blaze up. A man with no one near cries out, "Let go, you're throttling me," in a strangled voice. In an antechamber, four men are singing hymns into lamp glasses. Outside on the stairs are Mr. Van Damme's troupe of noises, and a very fine troupe they are, with wind machines, water machines, shotguns, bricks, chisels, drums, sandpaper, etc. Inside, the three devotees on the comfortable Persian carpet start to complain that they are drowning. One of them stamps up and down a specially prepared platform 4 feet long. Then one of them complains that he is being rescued. He seizes a bucket and shouts into it, gradually moving upstage. All the devotees seize buckets. Is this a savage ceremony or a channel crossing? And then someone steps forward, moves a little switch on the altar, and it's all over. And yet, however frenzied, confused the scene in the studio, to the listener in, all is clear and simple. What he's heard is an accident in a coal mine, where three visitors to the mine are entombed. He's heard the explosion and the flooding of the mine, and a party of miners in the next gallery singing hymns to keep up their courage, and the pics of the rescue party who finally save them. How does the microphone restore order to this higgledy-piggledy of sound? In the first place, sound has perspective as well as sight. Not only must the quality and volume of every sound be accurately gauged, but also its exact distance from the microphone. If you stand at the back of the studio, you get the perspective of sound in its wrong order, and it makes nonsense. If you stand close to the microphone, it all sorts itself out and comes right. But that's not the only difficulty. Some sounds that are all right when heard direct are no good when transmitted by the microphone. Mr. Van Damme's first attempts at a flood sounded splendid in the studio, but when I went into another part of the building and listened in, they sounded like a shop window full of puppies. He had to experiment till it sounded just right. Another thing that's very difficult is to get any sharp metallic sound. The clash of swords, for instance. It sounds like a battle of broomsticks. But these difficulties will be got over in time. And if Mr. Nigel Playfair's program has demonstrated anything, it is that the listening play, the unseen drama, will become an art of its own, as separate from the stage play as its elder brother, the film play, has already become.
Richard Hughes, reading his own newspaper account of the broadcast of the first BBC radio play, Danger, in January 1924.
Today, the BBC has the largest radio drama unit in the world. It's headed by Martin Esslin, and under his direction, it has won much acclaim and a number of awards, including the 1973 and 74 Italia Prizes for radio drama. We'll be hearing the 1974 production, The Mystery, right after we hear from Mr. Esslin. He was in Canada some time ago and recorded for Radio International these comments about the play and about his unit.
The radio drama department of the BBC is, I think, the largest there is in the world, certainly as far as output is concerned. We produce something of the order of 850 original productions of plays a year. On top of that, we do a very large amount of readings from novels and short stories and so on, a good deal of poetry programs, a certain amount of features. And the very number of plays, if one simply goes into the dramatic field, is enormous. It comes to something like two or three a day. All our directors and the staff, we've got something like 20 directors in London, something like 8 directors outside London, in Bristol, Cardiff, Birmingham, Leeds, Manchester, Glasgow, and Belfast. And we have a very important section of about 10 people who are our readers. There's the script unit, also they are fully employed by us, who read the enormous number of scripts we get, and who are also part-time producers, as indeed is the assistant head of the department and myself. So we have in fact something like a producer strength of about 34, 35 people, and these produce this enormous output. It is in that sense the largest theater in the world, I would say. We, of course, have our output, as it were, graded in the networks. We have a light network, which is called Radio 2, which has our soap opera in it. We've got a number one network, which hasn't got word transmissions at all, except news and a few commentaries. We have Radio 3, which is the serious music and the highbrow, the intellectual, experimental kind of drama and features. And we have Radio 4, which is the middle of the road, in which we put the main bulk of our output, which goes all the way from detective stories to Chekhov or Ibsen or Shakespeare. This enables us to cover the entire ground, and I think we are, again, unique, certainly in Britain, probably in the world, as being one organization which covers all kinds of drama, from soap opera to Samuel Beckett or Brecht. And our professional know-how, to a large extent, depends on the fact that we don't make gradation in level. between the people who do the soap opera and the people who do the Beckett. That is, the people who do the Beckett are as aware of the need to be entertaining, to have the value of suspense, of arousing interest, and all the techniques of that, as the people who do highbrow things are aware of the techniques of the lowerbrow work. As our department covers everything from the soap opera to Beckett, the chap who does Beckett also has, at one time or another, had to acquire the craftsmanship which he needs for Wagner's Walk or The Archers. And that, I think, is a very, very good school. And the level of our radio drama, I think, is shown by the fact that we have, in fact, now won the Italia Prize for the second year in succession with a piece which I think combines both the highbrow literary aspect, it's brilliantly written, and the entertainment value aspect. It's very, very entertaining. And that's the play you're going to hear now, which is The Mystery by Bill Norton, produced by Guy Vazin.
Martin Esslin, the head of BBC Radio Drama. Now, here's the production that won the 1974 Italia Prize. In stereo, The Mystery by Bill Norton.
I say, you there. Yes, I mean you. You listening. Well, don't. I mean it. Don't listen. I'll tell you what I want you to do. I know this must sound very sudden to you, and I ask you to excuse me, but I don't want you to get interested in any way. Don't get hooked, as they say. I want you to get up and come and switch this off. Don't let me or anyone else bamboozle you into giving up an hour of your life to listening to radio. It's not worth it. Life is really a mystery, you know, and they can't see it. So they make out it's not. They pretend they can lay it all out before you on the radio, television, the newspapers, what they call the media. And for that, they need your attention. Don't give it. Stand up, switch off, and no matter where you are, go outside. Go out into the fresh air. Don't talk to anyone. Don't give your attention to others. It's the most precious thing you have. You just go out into the fresh air. Just look up at the sky and the stars, if there are any. And then take your two hands like this and close your eyes and place the palms of your hands over so that for a moment you're aware of nothing but darkness. Darkness, with the entire universe stretching away for millions of light years, and in the infinite darkness and silence, whisper softly to yourself,
Edward! Edward! Are you there, Edward?
Damn and blast it, that's the wife. That old cow, excuse me, that woman gives me no peace. I'd better open the door and call to her. Sorry about this interruption, just when I was getting going.
Edward!
Yes, darling? I'm here in my room. What is it?
Did you clean up Sheba's droppings from the lawn?
Sheba's... What?
Oh, sorry. Were you by any chance working? I mustn't disturb you.
It's all right. I was just sort of writing something.
Oh, they make yellow patches.
What?
The droppings. There's a little heap over by the Prunus Pisardi.
Yes.
Don't forget, you've got to take her to the vet today, and I've arranged to have Bobby down at the same time. Otherwise, he'll soon start ponging. Toms do, you know.
Do they, really?
Well, I must get ready. I've got to be in town for lunch. Oh, by the way, talking of writing, did you get in touch with Mr. Hen?
Who?
Mr. Hen of Hen and Dingle. That script team. He said they had an interesting proposition to put to you.
I'd rather not bother.
I promised him faithfully that you'd ring back.
I don't like to get involved with such people.
Well, you don't have to get involved. You only have to ring them and say no.
I find that those sort of people always catch you out in some way.
Well, how can anybody catch you out, as you call it, if you don't want them to?
I don't know, but they do. Would you excuse me?
What?
I must go to the,
I'll answer it.
Yes, do. I must go to the, I'm not scared of her. Don't get that idea. I just like to preserve the peace. Besides, she's worked me round into a sort of defensive attitude. I find some people do that to me. A wife will, if you let her. So will a husband, I suppose. And you find yourself getting nervous before you've time to think. And another thing with a woman like that, there's none of the mystery of marriage. You know what I mean. I mean the simple mystery of a man and woman living together, sharing the same roof. I mean, that must have been so a million years ago, when a man and woman went into a cave together to start up a home. How mysterious. But it's not there with us. She's so direct. She talks it all away. And besides, I've got a nervous stomach. I say, I don't like the sound of that. Not on the radio. It's a bit on the nose. Conjures up images. Let's kill it with music. Thought closely of death. You must forgive my mentioning it. I know some people can't stand the sound of the word death, but I'll tell you why I am mentioning it. And I don't simply mean death and eternity. Fast as such a thought would be, it is perhaps too remote. I mean death. The moment of the final stopping of the heart. The end of all thought and feeling. The ceasing to be. To exist. A neighbour of ours, retired stockbroker, in fact a lord somebody or other, it doesn't matter, asked us round for drinks. He's a very wealthy man, and in fact, my wife's got money. She reads the Financial Times with her morning tea, and you know in the book where it says he cannot serve God and mammon? Only since I married her have I realized what it means. It's not that God would mind, it's mammon. He won't allow any infidelity. You must serve him with utter devotion, and he won't let you down. And he's made one inviolate rule for such as my wife: never, but never touch your capital. And as I say, bringing up the subject of death, this lord, somebody or other, had us round for drinks. Only a dozen or so people. He had this enormous estate. Widowed he was, huge country house. And just as we were about to go, my wife and I, in fact, we got into our car on this huge gravel forecourt. It's most uncomfortable stuff, gravel. When suddenly one of the maids called us back, somewhat in panic. His lordship seemed in an odd state. Would we come back in? My wife hurried ahead and I followed. She'd been the last one to talk to him, all about stocks and shares, and we were led to a small toilet. He'd collapsed, had a stroke or something, just as he was. Well, it could well have been out of good manners he'd put off going, and there he was. It was most pathetic, and oddly moving in a way, for suddenly it seemed he looked like a small, rather fat and pale-faced schoolboy. And four of us picked him up and lifted him on a couch in his room. The walls had numerous little plaques and things of what he'd won at various times. He'd won a lot, I must say, from being a schoolboy to being the top of the stock exchange. And there were at least 9 dozen invitations on the mantelpiece. And this chap who supervised the lift, I had hold of his legs, I mean his lordship's, this chap who supervised was a retired ship's doctor. And as his lordship let out a sigh, well, not a groan, a sigh, this doctor chap said, "I'm afraid it's all over." All over. And as I looked round the room, what struck me was...
Edward!
The bitch! Sorry. But how dare she call when she knows I'm in here? She's determined to get her own way. People with money nearly always are. Never marry outside your station, that's my advice. I'm more of the feeling kind. You know what I mean? Feeling, not acting. And I hope you are too. Well, the next hour is going to be something of a waste of time for all concerned.
Edward!
I'll give her Edward. Listen, I'll let you in on a tactic I've learnt. If ever you're involved with a neurotic partner, There's only one way of dealing with them. Work yourself up to a neurosis bigger and better than theirs. If they're neurotically mean, you be twice as mean. If they're neurotically clean, you be twice as clean. If they try to boss you, you boss them twice as much. If they shout, you rant and rave. Stop them every time. That takes the spotlight off them and they don't know what to do. D.H. Lawrence said, kick them in the jaw. Well, I don't think that's nice.
Edward, are you there?
Just watch this. What the hell are you going on about?
What? I was only...
Get on my masterpiece in this house without you come hammering on the door.
I only wanted to tell you...
I don't care what you wanted to tell me.
Atkins will hear you. She's in the kitchen.
I don't care who hears me. I won't have it. I won't be hounded around this house by you.
But I only came to tell you...
I don't care what you came to tell me. Even a man in prison is allowed to go to the bog in peace.
Edward!
Don't Edward me. I won't have you breathing down my neck.
But I wasn't...
Listen!
Don't squeeze my shoulders like that. It's all you don't know your own...
I know I don't, and if I have any more out of you, do you know what I'll do to you?
Don't look at me like that, Edward. You know I have to go to town. My shoulder is a funny spot for you to hold like that. And please don't kiss me. I've got to be in town.
I'm not going to kiss you.
I only came to tell you who it was on the telephone.
Who?
Mr. Dingle. I said you'd go there without fail early this evening. But you could drive up after you've left the animals with the vet. Edward, don't.
Well, here I am, out in the garden on this lovely summer morning. The air touched with nice smells of blossom, and I'm gathering dog turds with a twig and a spade. I feel it's not me, as they say. But then how little in life is actually me? Do you ever get that feeling? That you're not living? Not living your real life, but playing some role that circumstances have forced on you, and that it's been that way for most of your life, and for the better part of it, you've been miscast. I remember one thing from when I was a small boy. One evening, we were all sitting around the house. There were five of us children, and my mother and father. And there came one of those quiet moments you get in a home, and I chanced to look at my mother. I was a bit of a mother's boy, in fact, as you may have gathered. And she was sitting there mending socks, like mothers used to do in the old days. And she had this wool sock of my father's pulled over her hand. You know the way they used to do. And as I watched, I saw her look up and look at my father and then round at each one of us. And as she looked at me, I whispered, "What's up, Mum? What's on your mind?" And she looked at me like someone coming out of a daze. And she said, "I was just wondering, love, how I ever got myself mixed up with you lot."
Sheba, Sheba, now where have you been? Stop barking. We know you're here. Stop now.
I can't stand dogs barking on the radio, can you? I think it upsets animals in the home if there's a cat or a dog.
You don't know where I'm taking you today, and I'm glad you don't.
You know, I don't think it's right the way they have dogs spayed these days. I mean, so that they can't have any puppies. That, I suppose, is the way people are in these times. They want everything for their own convenience. They want all the pleasure of a dog's company, but none of the problems.
I don't like taking you, Sheba. I really don't. And here I am, pretending I'm your friend and master. Oh, but you're a lovely dog.
She is, too.
Do forgive me.
She will, too. Animals seem to forgive almost everything, although they never forget.
I'm taking Bobby as well. He's got to have his tonsils.
I think it's awful neutering a tomcat. I mean, what have you left the poor thing when you've taken that fan away? Poor old Bobby. By Jove, here he is, dead on cue.
Now, be quiet, Bobby. We don't want any meowing on the radio, thank you. There's a good chap. Come on, come on. I'll scratch your tummy. Roll on your back, you cheeky chap.
They're lovely animals, you know. I never realized what company they are. By the way, did you not feel I livened things up a bit back there? I mean, the encounter outside the lavatory door. That's something else worth bearing in mind, by the way, if you've got someone who rather likes setting about you. Get in first. Unfortunately, I couldn't keep it up. She must have spotted I was only coming in. Let's say I ran out of steam. But you'll find they never run out of steam. I mean people with money or people with power. They keep right on to the end. They're not like you and me. I'm talking. You're listening. They act. And they never run out until they run out of life. Before I met her, I was an artist. I didn't know it at the time. You don't, of course, until it's taken from you, like so much else in this life. I more or less did what was nearest my heart. And I lived in poverty. Holy and happy poverty. It's the only way to live if you aspire to even the lowliest artistic expression. For then you are on tap to humanity, and humanity is on tap to you. But when you put your faith in money, which I must have done when I married her, you lose your faith in life. That's the price you have to pay. And then, almost overnight, I had this tremendous success. Well, it was nothing really, just a short radio play, but the thing that intrigued people, it seemed, was the characters. It was all about the Thistle Twins, a deaf and dumb family. Father, mother, and teenage daughter and son. Not a one could speak a word. You can't imagine the radio producers that turned the idea down. They wouldn't hear of it. Family mutes on the radio, they said, you must be crazy. But it turned out to be dynamite. Well, not exactly dynamite, but it caught on. Much better than what you're listening to now. You had neighbours dropping in and one thing and another.
Miss Thistlethwaite, what's happened to your eye? Oh, he hasn't. Not again. He is a one, isn't he? I'll tell you what I'd do to him next time. Ooh, yes, I would. And I had him and his workmates, of course.
What were they doing, Harry, when you came upon them?
You don't say. With the postman? No wonder he's always late with the letters.
Nothing was spelled out, see, but everything understood.
I became a sort of celebrity overnight. Well, not overnight, but then I met this rich bitch.
Sorry. Actually, she's not a bad sort, really. A widow. Her first husband had money, so had she, and then she thought she'd get hold of a human being next time, never having allowed herself to be human herself.
Mr. Grock?
Oh, yes, Mrs. Atkins.
Your coffee. Shall I put it in your room, or would you like it out here?
I'll have it out here, please.
So that was the end of me. Money is the ruination of an artist. Comfort cuts him off, you know, and here I am, clearing up dog droppings.
What a lovely morning.
Isn't it?
Shall I leave the tray on the bench here, sir?
If you please.
Here. Let me take that shovel,
no,
sir.
No, not at all.
Oh, it won't take me a minute, sir. I'll dispose of it on the compost heap on my way back.
Well, thank you very much. Say, was that the cuckoo?
Yes, sir. Over in the little wood. Been there for some time.
Ah. Sheba, come on. Up here beside me. There's a good girl. Ooh. And Bobby, you come on my knee. There's a chap. Get used to each other.
Yeah. I must say, it's very pleasant here. Now is as good a time as any for you to switch off. For if you allow yourself to be distracted by others... By me, even. By me above all, perhaps. For now's your chance. Do you realize there are about 150 million television sets in use about the world today, and something like 500 million radio sets, thousands of daily newspapers, and they're all after one thing. Your attention. Once they've got that, they've got you. For they know you'll never find yourself. Self needs searching for, you know. It doesn't just give itself up. It needs silence to discover it. So, as I say, just reach out to that little knob or switch and turn me off. Then go out, go outside somewhere. Feel the air on your skin. Feel the fresh air in your lungs. Look up at the sky. Then close your eyes, shut out the entire world. And then...
Edward! Edward!
That bitch again, blast her. Every bloody time I...
Yes, darling?
You are. With the animals.
Yes, darling.
Don't move. I'm just going. I don't know what time I shall be back. I'm lunching with Mabel. And then I have some shopping to do. Oh, and I've got to go over to the city.
Ah, to see your Mr. Doolally.
Lally. Mr. Lally. I want him to...
Take a look at your portfolio.
Well, amongst other things. Now, about all you have to do, Edward. First, the animals.
But do we really have to have them done?
But of course. Everybody has these days. Otherwise, my little Bobby will begin to smell. won't you, Bobby?
Not really. I mean, after all, it will be his own smell. And there are smells and smells, and there are things one must learn to put up with. I mean, for the pleasure of an animal's company.
Nonsense. It's perfectly simple. The vet just snips them off, the gonads, or whatever they call them. Oh, of course, they'll keep them in overnight.
She knows. Oh, Sheba knows. I mean, just look at
her. Don't be silly. You love it, Sheba, won't you? Not to have all those naughty boy doggies coming chasing after you, sniffing around. And Bobby will stay home instead of going off. We'll collect them tomorrow. Oh, and don't forget Hen and Dingle. You know their office is just off Shaftesbury Avenue.
I know.
I don't know what time I shall be back. I might be late.
You will if old Ulalli has anything to do with it.
I'll get Atkins to leave everything handy for you. Oh, and you'll need to run her home at 3 o'clock. And don't forget to be at the vet's on time. And then go on...
Let's have some music over this lot. It's all a terrible bore. We're in my motor car, as you can hear. I'm driving Mrs. Atkins home, so let's lose the car sounds. Let's concentrate on Mrs. Atkins. She's a rather well-set-up woman, is Mrs. Atkins. In her early 40s, I'd say. Yes, just about in them. And there beside the gear stick, I can see her knees as I'm talking to you. And she's got very shapely legs. And I'd just love to caress her knees, for they look very round and supple. Amazing knees for a woman who is a daily help. And she has a nice, fresh-skinned look. Composed, with a sort of dignity that people who work have and people who don't work can never acquire. She's cheerful enough. Not the least sign of anything coquettish. And I'm here beside her driving, and we're not saying a word. I gather she lives alone. Husband went off with some young thing, so I gather, but apparently it's something she doesn't talk about. It's going to be about a 10 minutes drive or more. And in a way, I wish you were listening to my deaf and dumb play about the Thistlethwaites, which had more in it, really. So if you don't mind, I'll work in the scene which the young daughter Millie, who is 17 and works at a shoe factory, has with her friend's mother, a neighbour, Mrs. Kite, Auntie Flo, she calls her, mother of the twins, Alan and Peter, two nice young chaps who live a couple of doors away.
Oh, hello, Millie. Is that you? Carol isn't home yet. Oh, you know, do you? Well, sit down. I'm just having a cup of coffee. And there's one for you. Never mind, no. Sit yourself down there at the table beside me. I'm glad to rest me feet. And have a cup of coffee. And a chocolate biscuit. Oh, what are you shaking your head for? What do you mean? Oh, you don't want any coffee. And you don't want a biscuit. You're looking pale, dear. Are you feeling all right? What's the matter? Come on, tell me. Don't bury your head down. Lift your face up, Millie, and tell Auntie Flo what it's all about. Come on, now. Oh, that's better. Now, what's upset you? Yes, love? You mean you're... Oh, you're not, love, are you? Oh, you can't be. Well, yes, if you say you are, I expect you know. Have you told your mother? You haven't. Oh, I see. I'm the first. Now, who is it? shaking your head? You can tell me, because you're going to need some help, love. Come on now. Who is the father? Who? Who did you say? Alan? Our Alan! My boy, Alan! Well, never. Are you sure, love? Absolutely positive. Oh, well, he'll have to marry you. I'll see to that. Oh, but that is a shock. What? What are you shaking your head about? I'll see he marries you if it's the last thing I do. What's that? You don't want to marry him? Why? Won't you tell me? He's got a good job. What? Because you what? You don't love him? Well, I never.
You don't love him, but you...
What? What do you say? You love Peter. You love my boy, Peter. But if you love my boy, Peter, why did you let... What's that? Oh. Show me again, love. Peter doesn't love you. And you? You what? Oh, yeah, I don't follow you. Write it down there. You imagined it was Peter. Oh. Oh, poor little girl. All right. Have you sobbed? Have you sob out, love? It'll all come right in the wash, as they say.
Now, who owned the stage there? Or should it be the microphone? Little Millie, of course, and she never spoke a word. Just one sob at the end. I wish I could have finished it for you, but we're getting near Mrs. Atkins' place.
It's a sharp turn, just here, sir, down the narrow road to the house. So, if you like, I'll walk.
Not after you've been working all morning.
Somehow, it doesn't feel like work to me. Taking over an untidy house in the morning, cluttered and unbright, and transforming it into a scene of quiet order. I feel better after it.
Allow me, Mrs. Atkins.
Thank you.
Sheba. I'm afraid I've not been honest over that last bit. I never told you about the dog and the cat being in the car. The fact was, I was so depressed over it, I tried to shut it out of my mind. We had to trick young Bobby into the kitchen, Mrs. Atkins and myself, and then get him into the cat basket. What a job we had. He knew. I'd better open the boot, give him some air. You all right, Bobby? He knows, poor chap. It does seem awful, you know, taking them away to have them cut off. They always seem to me a tomcat's pride and joy, swinging away at the back. And now we're depriving him of them. I suppose you've got to do something. As for Sheba, sitting on the back seat...
Doesn't she look sad, sir? The way she's looking at you with those brown eyes. It's as though she fears something and she doesn't quite know what it is. Excuse me, but... You wouldn't like a cup of tea, would you?
Well, I suppose I have an hour or two to fill in. I wasn't quite sure what I'd do. Yes, if it's no trouble.
No trouble at all.
I say, I hope I haven't got you too interested in the Thistlethwaite girl, Millie, pregnant by Alan and in love with Peter, or in Bobby the cat, shut away inside his cat basket, in the open boot of the car, about to be driven to the vets to have his masculinity removed. Now, to me, that is real drama, almost real tragedy. And for me, at the moment, that lovely, virile cat is the centre of the stage. However, don't worry too much for him. I've got the feeling it won't turn out too badly. He might escape. And there's our dog, Sheba. They have hysterical pregnancies, you know. They make up a place to have their young, and they show all the signs, and it turns out to be nothing. Anyway, in a word or two... All the offstage actors are holding the center of the stage, you might say.
I say, Mrs. Atkins, this is a very pleasant cottage you have here.
It's rather small, but it seems to suit me.
I like this room. It's so very cozy.
A little dark, don't you think?
Well, that's exactly what I like. One needs contrast, you know. I find our house rather too light. What a nice sofa this is.
Well, make yourself comfortable. I'll go off and make the tea, if you'll excuse me.
Lovely sofa. She's quite an attractive woman now, one sees her in her own surroundings. One thing I do detest is going to see these hen and dingle pair. Because one rule I've learnt in life is that it's wiser to have nothing to do with people who have different ideas from you. It never works. Well, I know it sounds narrow-minded. And I suppose my wife is right. I've only to say no and it's all over. But it never seems to work out that way.
Good afternoon. Can I help you?
Good afternoon. My name is Grock, Edward Grock.
Have you an appointment?
Yes. I believe my wife made one.
Your wife made one for you?
Yes, that's right. Over the telephone. You got in touch with us. I mean, Mr. Hen and Mr. Dingle asked to see me.
They asked to see you?
Yes, they said they had a proposal to make.
A proposal?
A proposition. Look, I'm sorry, but I can't waste my time.
Oh, don't go. Please, I'll tell Mr. Hen you're here. I was only getting the facts right. What did you say your name was?
Grock. Edward Grock.
Very well, Mr. Grock. I won't be a moment.
I hate offices and the people in them. They make me uncomfortable. And have you ever noticed in this life, those who make the most fuss over inviting you always contrive the worst welcome when you get there? They sometimes have a little room off, a sort of waiting room where they make you wait a few minutes or longer just to sort of cool your cooler. And I'll bet when she comes back, she'll say, Mr. Hen is engaged, and asks, would I mind waiting a minute or two? I knew I should never have come.
Oh, Mr. Grock, Mr. Hen is engaged and asks, would you mind waiting a minute or two?
Look, tell him I'll call some other time.
He won't like it if you go.
I should worry. In fact, I wouldn't be here at all if it weren't for my wife. I believe in doing things my own way. I find it the only way in the long run, but as she said, go and see them. What harm can it do?
Exactly. What harm can it do? And I do believe I just heard Mr. Hen put the telephone down. I'll tell him you're here.
All a put-up job, you know. Anyway, I'll tell them what to do with their proposals. That's the marvellous thing when you no longer need their money.
Oh, Mr. Grock, is that you? How do you do? How are you?
Oh, hello.
Sorry you were kept waiting. We have met at that party recently. Do come into my office.
Look, I'm not sure. I mean, I only came to tell you I'm not free for work.
Oh, come on in. I simply daren't let you go. Mr. Dingle will want to see you. You can tell all that to him. You know how much we admire
yes,
your
but...
work. Sit down in the armchair.
But I'm not...
I'll tell Tony you're here.
Look here, Grock. No beating about the bush. We write scripts for all media, or at least we get them written... And we'd employ you on a retainer basis, say, $1,000 a year?
I tell you, I'm not interested. And I'm certainly not interested in that sort of money.
That's only the retainer.
Julian, keep out of this. I only wanted the reaction. Let's make it $2,000 a year retainer.
$2,000 doesn't interest me either. I tell you,
that's only the retainer. You get paid on
Julian,
top of...
Julian, quiet. Go make Eddie a drink.
No, thanks.
Make him one of your specials, Julian.
Yes, I will. A very special...
Yeah, but I...
No buts, Eddie. You don't mind me calling you Eddie?
I don't mind, thanks.
Let's get down to business. Suppose we start off with this contract and put the retainer down at £5,000 a year.
Quiet,
Julian. Hand Eddie his drink. Let's hear what he has to say.
Cheers. I suppose $5,000 isn't bad for a retainer, but...
Well, you'd earn $20,000 at least on top of it, with a guaranteed minimum of £1,000 a script.
But that's impossible.
Shut up, Julian. What do you say, Eddie? Would you like to sign? I'll fill in the details now, and you can read and sign.
But that's more than we're...
Julian. Now, Eddie, where's the pen?
No, thanks.
What? Do you mean
you... Julian, shut up. Now, what do you mean, no thanks?
I mean, no thanks. There's enough crap going out without my adding to it.
You mean...
I mean, I'm not going to write anything for you or for anyone else. I'm free, and I'm going to stay that way. I'm going to keep to myself what I write, and now I'll be off.
But you're already adding to it.
Adding to what? How do you mean?
Julian, tell him.
You're already working for us. Doing scripts for us ever since you came in. You're not free.
What the hell are you talking
We've
about?
We've got your actual dialogue. Every word. Julian, tell Peter I want the playback.
From where he came in?
Yes.
Hello? Control room? Yes, Peter.
Shoals, Peter here.
Edward Grockfile, would you play back to us?
Where from?
The opening, when he came in.
No, give us a bit from his wife's telephone talk, and we only want bits.
Start with wife, just bits along the way, for flavour.
Right, but I'll keep recording on number two.
Oh, yes, don't miss anything.
Look, I'm going. I've had enough of this.
You finish your drink and stay where you are, mister.
Don't take it.
Julian, fasten the armchair belt across and lock it. I'll hold him.
Right.
What's that? Take your filthy hands off me.
No.
Got it.
Try to move out of that. You won't get very far.
Shut up. You'll do nothing.
Carry on, Peter.
Good afternoon. Can I help you?
Good afternoon. My name is Grock. Edward Grock.
Which is not good dialogue.
Yes,
too flat, but it'll come up. It'll come up.
Your wife?
Yes, that's right.
Very well, Mr. Grock. I won't be a moment.
Shut that bloody thing off!
Don't struggle, Grock.
You pair of fools, I can get round this tomfoolery any time.
Julian, switch off.
I'll get round it.
I won't speak. I'll close my mouth now. You won't get another word out of me, no matter what you do.
Oh, won't we just?
Julian, bring in Alice from the desk. Ask her to bring my instrument case. I'll watch him.
Oh, yes,
sir. Grock, you're an idiot. Sitting there, strapped down in your armchair, pale-faced and sweating with your lips shut. Silence! You should realize, above all, that silence is the best radio. Actors fear it, directors don't understand it, writers ignore it, but listeners stretch their eardrums.
So do you, swine!
Just missed, old chap. I say, Grock, to be serious for a moment, don't you realize who we are? We are the mediocrities. The mediocrities. You can't beat us. We don't allow your sort to get the upper hand. We nip you in the bud. We are in charge of the whole world over. We recognize each other, understand each other, help each other. It is the conspiracy of all time. The conspiracy of mediocrity. We simply use your sort.
I'll kick your...
Missed again. Rotten shot.
Being naughty is here. We'll soon put a stop to that.
Alice, open the instrument case for me.
Yes, here we are.
Julian, get his trousers down.
No, don't. Get away. Get your hands off me, you fat, filthy pig.
Take no notice. Alice, hand me the forceps.
Which tissue or artery?
Neither. I'll use the tooth-dissecting forceps. Oh, and the long probe and clamp.
Clamps?
Dissecting forceps?
Thank you.
Long probe and clamp.
Give me a hand, one of you.
Julian, hold him down. Alice, pull his trousers right down.
No.
Yes.
No. All right, I've got
him. Julian, we are recording, aren't we?
Oh, yes. Peter has it running.
Good. I'm down on his foot. Ooh. Now let's see what we can do.
I've got him. Oh, I say, what fancy underwear.
Leave it alone.
Alice, down with his fancy underwear.
No, come on, down. No, please don't.
Quiet, I won't hurt you. The cold steel may feel chilly against your skin for a moment, but the cutting you won't feel. I promise you, a clean job.
Oh, God, help me, God, help me.
Mr. Grock, what is it? Are you all right?
Where am I?
You're in my cottage, on the sofa.
Oh, yes, of course. Thank heaven you wakened me. I'm sorry.
You had a little nightmare, no doubt. My, you're all of a sweat. Let me wipe your forehead with this towel.
Thanks, that feels better. Could I please hold your hand, Mrs. Atkins?
By all means. Or let me hold yours. How's that?
What a cool, strong hand you've got. Such firm fingers and a broad palm. I love such hands.
You wouldn't if I gave you a belt with one.
What? What did you say?
Nothing worth repeating, just a passing thought.
I had a frightful nightmare.
Yes, they are frightful. You look rather pale.
I feel like a lost little boy. Could I stand and take my jacket off?
Yes, why don't you?
Let me take it, sir. There. I'm sure that's better. My, you're a bit tottery on your feet.
Mrs. Atkins, would you mind if I put my arms around you? I feel...
Your arms round me? Yes, I don't mind. If it'll help.
I mean, like this. Around your shoulders, sort of, and just lean my face against you like this.
I don't mind, sir.
This is more like it, eh? I didn't care for that dream scene in the office with the instruments. Actors nearly always go over the top if you give them anything like that, especially with a few ad-libs in. They take the bit between their teeth. Still, I'm glad you stayed with me. I'd have been tempted to switch off. I love the feel and the smell of this jersey. This soft wool.
Yes. Wool has something comforting.
When worn by a warm woman. Oh, don't back away.
I'm sorry.
That's better. You don't mind my holding on tight, Mrs. Atkins?
No. Why should I?
She's got a most marvellous bosom. Warm, firm and comforting. Like women had in the old days. I remember I used to hang on to my mother like this when I was about 4 and came home crying from school. Mrs. Atkins?
Yes, Mr. Grock.
You wouldn't... I mean, could you see your way to put your arms round me? Just for a moment.
I don't really see why not. We're two adult and, I hope, responsible beings. Now, how does that feel? It doesn't seem quite spot on to me.
Let's unmingle our arms and try again. See what happens.
Ah, that's better. Is it what you had in mind?
Not exactly. It feels more wonderful than I could have anticipated.
If you'll forgive a personal remark, Mr. Grock.
But certainly.
It's most... Oh, but never mind.
Are you... I was going to ask. A... keep fitter?
Not really. Except if one's given a body, it seems somewhat ungracious to return it in a poorer shape than need be.
You know that mysterious thing I was telling you about, between man and woman? It's happening here with Mrs. Atkins, at this very moment. Can you feel my heart, Mrs. Atkins? Sort of pulsing.
I can feel a throbbing, but couldn't say for sure it was your heart or mine or what. You were very upset back there, of course.
Yes, wasn't I? Hold on to me, please. Oh, she's got one of those firm yet supple figures. She feels strong without being muscular. Her thighs feel very firm yet not bulky. And she's got warm, generous arms. Hold me securely yet not tightly. And most fragrant womanly smell and such lovely, soft, mysterious hair. I say, it's not bad radio either. I mean, this sort of thing. It's the sort of thing I like. I can well imagine you're thinking it's going to lead up to something, and I only hope you're right. Mrs. Atkins, do you think we could have just one kiss?
But I am kissing you, sir.
Kissing me?
Since I saw you crying in your sleep, I've been kissing you.
You've been...
Yes. In my heart. We don't need mouths to kiss, do we?
I thought they were rather handy. I mean, that sort of thing.
Oh, I agree. I believe that all the physical attributes of expressing love are most handy, once one learns to match them up properly.
Just what I was thinking. Mrs. Atkins, as I stand here pressed to you so warmly close, there emanates from you such a wonderful...
Oh, thank you, Mr. Grock. Yes. For me, this embrace is a most joyous thing. And where is it happening? In the heart.
Yes. But can't you feel...
Everything that happens to a human being, or so I've come to believe, takes place in the heart. everything that is of any significance at all. I'm inclined to believe that something not lacking in significance has passed between us, Mr. Grock.
But surely...
Then why should we belittle it? Be less than satisfied with it? For not only can it not be taken from us, but being in the heart, it can continue to happen, even when we're apart. Isn't that a wonderful thing? So why should we push our luck, as they say? Besides, the tea will be getting cold.
Could have stayed standing all day long up there, front to front with Mrs. Atkins and her arms round each other. But I had to bring the animals along here to the vet surgery to be neutered, and I'm in the waiting room with a few others. Bobby is in his basket, a pathetic sight, as I can just make him out through the sides. The fight gone out of him, and he is crouched there, fearful and apprehensive, for he knows quite well what's going to happen to him. They're going to nip out his masculinity, all his lusty sexual vigour, his ancient appetite. No kittens will flow from his limbs. It's a damn shame, you know, and I don't care what people say, it simply is not right. As for Sheba, she's lying down with her chin on my shoe. She seems more resigned to a life of barrenness, yet in some way she's even more pathetic. The dog is. She's trying to tell me she still trusts me. She can't stop looking up at me with those large, trusting eyes of hers.
A nice, quiet dog you've got there.
Yes, she is very good.
Well, most dogs are, if you treat them right.
Yes, I suppose so.
They're the same as us. In fact, I always say dogs follow after their owners. Have you ever noticed that?
Yes, sort of, in a way.
Mine's 12. Aren't you Joey? Mm? You'd never think it, would you?
You certainly wouldn't.
I like a poodle. There's such fun about the place. I bought him for company when my husband died.
I see.
Do you know, in a way, he's better company. I mean, Joey.
Is he really?
Well, the thing about a dog, they don't ask for explanations. If you're up, they know. If you're down, they know. If you're in a good mood, they join in. If you're in a bad mood, they join in. If you're in a bad mood, they don't want to know why. They always take you as you are.
I suppose that is true.
But my husband, well, I didn't understand him at all until his last illness. And then it all came out. Pain, you see, brings it out. His natural self. It was a transformation. We could have started all over again then, lived a happy life. But it was too late. Do you find me talkative?
Not really.
He always said I had too much to say. Oh, hello.
Hello. I telephoned him and they said I could come and collect Timmy.
It's her catsy. They've had it in.
Yes, I'd had it castrated like.
Neutered, dear.
It's the same thing, isn't it? I wanted him more at home with me, but it didn't take properly.
I see.
So he's been in for nearly a week. And it's been the longest week in my life. I have missed him.
Now, which one of you is next?
I believe you are.
Oh, thank you.
Have you got my Timmy for me?
Yes, he's here. Is this your basket?
Yes, it is. Timmy? Timmy? I am glad to see you.
I mean, I've brought them both along, but I thought I'd ask your advice before the actual operation.
This is a bonny dog you've got here, aren't you, old girl? Now, she will tend to go fatter, perhaps a lot, if you don't watch her. And they don't seem to live quite as long.
Do you know, after what you said, I don't think I'll bother to have Sheba done.
Might be just as well. She's a nice dog as she is.
Now, about Bobby, our tomcat here. Have you any views on that?
Well, tomcats are tomcats. But I'll put it this way. We wouldn't like it done to us, would we?
I think that's all I need to know. Thank you very much.
Do you remember when I was saying to you this morning about switching off? Well,
Bobby, Bobby, how do you expect me to play if you're trying to walk on the keyboard? You want to go out, is that it? All right, come on. I'll let you out through the window. Oh, what a lovely night. Well, Bobby, what are you sniffing it for? What are you going to do? Go out, eh? All right, goodbye then. Have a nice time. Don't get in too many fights. You don't know what a lucky escape you've had. Or do you? See you in the morning. Sheba, what about you? Do you want to go to... No, you like to lie there under my feet. All right. Be quiet then. Yes, as I was saying, why don't you switch off just now? Come and turn the knob or the switch. Blast, is that her car?
Oh!
I might have known. Still, I mustn't be like this. I mustn't be like it. I mustn't get nervous. All right, Sheba, calm down, calm down. I must calm myself. She's really quite nice once you know her. I've perhaps given you a wrong impression of her. If you met her, you might think differently. I mean, from what I do. Quite a number of people are very fond of her and can't stand me. I've told you everything from my point of view. I feel I've suffered from her in a way.
Edward?
Edward? I wonder why she always calls me that. It could be her nerves.
Oh, Edward. You're in here.
Yes, my dear.
Oh, Sheba, Sheba, down. Down, now, my sweetie. Oh, there, there. Edward? What's Sheba doing at home? Didn't you go?
You're quiet, Sheba. There's a good girl. Now, settle down. Yes, I went. Did you see Dulally? I mean, did he inspect your...
Lally? No. There was only the old man there, and he's no use. He's mad about guilt. Now, what happened? I mean, at the...
I suddenly had a change of mind.
And where's Bobby? Did you leave him there?
No. I just let him out. Through the window there.
But, I mean... Did you go to town to see...
No, not really. I felt it better to keep away.
Have you been working, then?
No, not really. I seem just to have been noting down one or two things as the day went on.
But what did the vet say? Did he mind?
I don't think so. When I asked him about Bobby, he said something about tomcats being tomcats. And then he said, I'll put it this way. We wouldn't like it done to us, would we? And when I looked at it that way, I felt we ought to put up with a bit of a smell. And he's wandering off, too. As for Sheba, he thought she was a bonny dog, as he put it, and that she'd go fat after we'd had her done, and she wouldn't live as long. And it struck me that perhaps we were depriving her. I thought we might let her have just the one litter sometime or other. I mean, a bitch without ever a chance of a pup seems sort of lonely. Well, what's the matter, dear?
I don't know. It's just that I didn't think you... Sheba, stop licking my face. I'm all right.
She's full of compassion and concern. Down, Sheba, there's a girl. Darling, let me get you.
Stop it. Don't.
Don't what?
Don't be so bloody tender. I can't bear it.
Darling, but I'm always tender.
You simply talk to me off the top of your bloody head. And it's not what you say. The feeling that comes over. You think I'm nothing but a mean, bossy, money-grabbing old cow. Well, maybe I am. One has to have something in life. That bit of tenderness caught me unawares. I'm sorry. I didn't expect it. I'll go and make us a bit of supper.
never saw myself like that. I suppose one doesn't. Here, Sheba. Go after her. Keep her company. There's a girl. She could be right. She could, for sure. Anyway, if I were you, I'd quietly switch off now. I'd go outside, or open a window wide, and I'd look up, and then I'd close my eyes, then put my hands gently over them, and just whisper, very softly, bloody hell.
On Radio International, The Mystery by Bill Naughton, the BBC production that won the 1974 Italia Prize for Radio Drama. In the cast were Norman Rodway as Edward. Edith was played by Irene Sutcliffe. Mrs. Atkins, Anne Morrish. Mrs. Kit, Peggy Aitchison. Alice, Julie Hallam. Hen, Fraser Kerr. Dingle, Anthony Jay. The poodle owner, Diana Bishop. The vet, Leonard Fenton. The cat owner, Doreen Andrew. And Peter, Sam Daster. The producer was Guy Vason.
We'll have another Italia Prize-winning production next week. It's from NHK, Japan's broadcasting organization. It won the 1973 Music Award, and it's called Children and Words in This World. It's an imaginative anthology in stereo of poems, songs, and chants by children, which reflect their view of life today, and we hope you can be here for it.
Before we leave you this week, we have a bonus from the BBC. We've heard from BBC Radio Drama, and now we have something from the music department, one of their most popular presentations. The BBC Henry Wood Prom Concerts play every year to packed houses at Albert Hall, and the final night of each annual series traditionally becomes a happy circus. 7,000 people, the lucky ones of over 50,000 who have entered the lucky draw for tickets, show up. Many of them, young people with colored paper hats and umbrellas, noisemakers and leather lungs, who cheer the musicians as though they were football players. We end Radio International tonight with part of The Last Night of the Proms of September 13th, 1969, introduced by your intrepid BBC announcer and conducted by Colin Davis.
And things, as you can doubtless hear, are very much as always. Shouts for Colin Davis already. Good evening, and welcome to the Royal Albert Hall's annual Jamboree, the night the circus leaves town, so to speak. Well, the pattern is generally, very generally, as it always has been, in a sense more so, because this being the centenary year of the birth of Sir Henry Wood, such changes as there are take us further back into tradition. And first we shall hear the overture Cockaigne by Elgar, cheerful and Londony, stout and steady, as he said, dedicated to my friends, the members of the British orchestras.